in Kensington. It's like we pull out all the stops here. That's amazing. Well, obviously we're talking about alcohol in the last week in our Crave series, but I feel like I need to introduce myself. How many have no idea who I am? Okay, a fair number of you. My name is Craig Mays, and I'm one of the teaching pastors at Kensington. And if you've been here a few months, you might have seen me in the India videos because I'm kind of the point person for our work in India. I'm also, if you've heard the name, my wife and Chris and I are planning the church in New York City starting this summer. And listen to this, we're bringing a group of almost 40 people, counting kids, from Kensington to New York City. Isn't that awesome? And I do want to tell you, by the way, it's not too late to be a part of this adventure that will ruin your life. You know, sell your house in this environment. Can you imagine that? And then live into this teeny little apartment. But Clint gave me permission to invite you guys to come. Even half of you, he said, could leave. In fact, half of you, he said he wants to leave. Just kidding. But anyhow, it's a real pleasure after all these months. I've been here on the weekend service, and I've sat out where you sat a few times, but this is my first chance to be up front, and it's just a real joy to see what God's doing in the west suburbs. I lived actually at Lasser and 12 Mile for years and years, almost 7 years, so this feels a little bit like coming back home, but it is great to be here. Well, we are going to be talking about a topic that touches all of our lives, whether directly or we know someone. Maybe in our family, maybe a loved one, maybe someone in the cube next to us at work, someone that struggles with this issue of alcohol. And if you're new to Kensington, it might feel kind of strange to hear a song like that. By the way, how many of you like country? Wow, it just surprises me. You know, Birmingham, I thought it would be, you know, maybe jazz or something. I have to tell you, country's not one of the buttons I push on my radio ever, but they did a great job with it. But the reality is we want to tackle issues that are real. I mean, we're real people. We live in a real world. And church should not feel disconnected from life. That's one of our convictions. And so we're going to be talking about this topic. And I'm going to read something. But before I do that, just to let you know, out of this speech I'm going to read, we're going to have an opportunity to see on video for about 20 minutes a conversation that took place between Dave Wilson, who's kind of our lead teaching pastor, and Dr. Jack Wilson, who's a clinical psychologist, who's been a friend of Kensington for years and has tried to help us all become a little bit more healthy. And he's really an expert in the area of substance abuse and alcohol. So I think you're really going to be informed by that. And then I'm going to come up after that and teach a little bit. But I want to read something for you that I find so interesting. I don't know if you know this, but when Prohibition ended, there were some states that took time to kind of come back on where they would allow alcohol in their state. And the last one, it wasn't until, I think, 1952. And that state was Mississippi. And there was a man, listen to this name. His name was Noah S. Soggy Sweet, Jr. And he was a judge and a lawmaker, and he was asked, because the battle was waging over, should we allow alcohol in our country or our state or not again? And so he was asked to give a speech, and I want to read the speech. It's pretty famous. It's called the Whiskey Speech. And try to imagine that I'm saying it with a southern drawl, because I'm sure it was much more powerful with that, but I'm not an actor, so I can't do that. But here we go. Here's what he said. He said, "My friends, I had not intended to discuss this controversial subject at this particular time. However, I want you to know that I do not shun controversy. On the contrary, I will take a stand on any issue at any time, regardless of how fraught with controversy it might be. You have asked me how I feel about whiskey. All right. Here is how I feel about whiskey. If when you say whiskey, you mean the devil's brew, the poison scourge, the bloody monster that defiles innocence, dethrones reason, destroys the home, creates misery and poverty, yea, literally takes the bread from the mouths of little children. If you mean the evil drink that topples the Christian man and woman from the pinnacle of righteous, gracious living into the bottomless pit of degradation and despair and shame and helplessness and hopelessness, then certainly I am against it. But if, when you say whiskey, you mean the oil of conversation, the philosophical wine, the ale that is consumed when good fellows get together, that puts songs in their hearts and laughter on their lips and the warm glow of contentment in their eyes, if you mean Christmas cheer, if you mean the stimulating drink that puts the spring in the old gentleman's step on a frosty, crispy morning, if you mean the drink which enables a man to magnify his joy and his happiness and to forget, if only for a little while, life's great tragedies and heartaches and sorrows. If you mean the drink, the sale of which pours into our treasuries untold millions of dollars, which are used to provide tender care for our little crippled children, our blind, our deaf, our pitiful aged and infirm, and to build highways and hospitals and schools, then certainly I am for it. This is my stand. I will not compromise. And so now, here's what Dr. Jack Wilson has to say about alcohol.
Gets at the conflict, the controversy that our society has when it comes to alcohol. Is it appropriate to drink it, good and bad? And that's what we're tackling today. It's a pretty big topic and something I really think is going to be a great, great weekend. And to do that, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to interview a friend of mine, Jack Wilson, who is a PhD in counseling psychology. He's taught in this area and trained in this area of substance abuse for over 30 years. And every time I sit with Jack, and you're going to find the same thing today, there's just wisdom from his life and from his training and teaching. So we decided to bring him in and say, let's talk about this issue of alcohol. So first question, Jack, would be this. You know the whiskey speech. You brought it to us. So there's that debate of good and bad. How do you look at this whole thing in alcohol in our society?
Yeah, that's the reason I really like that particular speech, because it does do such a good job of summing up, you know, all the ways of looking at alcohol and the ways our society looks at it. And I really believe both sides are correct. If you are a moderate user of alcohol, if you don't have a physiological predisposition where it becomes dangerous to you, I have no objections to appropriate use of alcohol. But we have to always be cognizant and aware that there are individuals out there for whom, because of a variety of different factors which we'll talk about, it's simply not safe for them to consume alcohol. But we don't want to just talk about the individual who has the problem with alcohol. We also want to make sure that we take a look at the impact that it has on their family, because this becomes a spiritual issue, a moral issue that has great impact on everybody around the person who is doing the drinking, all the way out to the larger society.
What are the stats? I mean, what kind of, you know, what's going on in our culture right now in regards to alcohol in families, individuals, whatever?
Well, what we know is the approximate percentage that most professionals are comfortable with is 15% of the population have serious issues when they consume alcohol. It's a little tricky, though. I said 15% of the population, but that doesn't address people who don't drink. There are a lot of people out there who don't drink, and they're not in our statistics in terms of problem drinkers. But what we do know is individuals, let's say from within that 15% who have difficulty with alcohol, 35% of them, fully 35% of them, would fit any definition of alcoholism that we could possibly come up with.
Now, how would you define an alcoholic?
Well, there's always been a lot of argument, and I even think it's a canard, about whether the alcoholism is a disease or is not. And I'm just going to say, yes, it is. I don't want to take a lot of time on that, but it is a disease, and it's a disease that is characterized by a loss of control. It's progressive, and if it continues through its progression, it's fatal. Let me give you an example. What I mean by that is society, much like the whiskey speech, we're confused. We have an image of an alcoholic as being the derelict, the skid row bum. That's not the typical alcoholic. Alcoholism exists on a continuum from an individual because of some predisposition is beginning to develop the disease, and that's where we want to step in, that's where we want to have an impact.
Which blows the myth, because the college guy who can drink everybody under the table is the stud. You're the man because you can hold more alcohol, and you're saying that guy or that gal is actually in more trouble than the guy who can't drink a beer or two.
Yeah. The other thing that we see is people who won't go or won't be involved in a social activity or an event unless alcohol is served. The guy that won't play on the slow pitch team, you know, or the girl that won't go to the party. Just think of all the things you've heard, you and Ann have said in a room when you're doing premarital counseling, the debate over serving or not serving alcohol at the reception. Well, if we don't serve alcohol at the reception, my uncles won't come.
Exactly.
Okay. See the power, you know, that culture begins to exhibit and how normative it becomes. Well, whenever I hear those kinds of things, then as a professional, I start going, we better ask some more questions here, because it looks to me like we're beginning to move into the area of significant alcohol abuse.
Yeah. When When does a person decide it would be safe for me or it would not be safe for me to even become a social drinker, maybe?
Well, I would say for you as an individual or for anybody listening to this, do your own family tree. Go back at least two or three generations and look around to see whether there have been some folks that the family referred to as problem drinkers or Uncle Ned couldn't really handle his booze. And the closer it is to you, the more at risk you are of being in that 15% of people for whom alcohol can be a serious problem. So if one or more of your parents would be someone that you would think of that didn't handle alcohol well, created confusion in the family life because of it, then I would say that's a point at which you should be seriously considering the way you use alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, let's push that a little bit. What does that mean? Well, what that means is that if you have one or more parent who is an alcoholic, you have a 5 times higher probability of having the predisposition to this disease than someone who doesn't.
So I've heard you talk about the 3 P's. You just mentioned one of them. What are the other P's that you think of when you dig around your family tree?
Well, you when you're digging around and taking a look at things, you want to see what precipitates your drinking, and that's the culture that you grew up in. It's the advertising. It's the billions of dollars that we have in media. Frankly, I think most people in the room would agree the best and funniest TV ads, are the alcohol ads. They do a great job. But that's all part of the precipitating thing in terms of that we as a culture say it's okay. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it relates to public drunkenness. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it comes to drunken driving. Most of the other countries in the world are nowhere near as tolerant. That's a precipitating issue. And then the next issue becomes the perpetuation of the issue. Are you going to continue doing it? And when we look at perpetuating, we come to another diagnostic category, which is extremely important, and it's really kind of the capstone category, and that's, do you continue drinking in spite of negative consequences? If you have had a couple of negative consequences and you cut way back, stop drinking, don't drink at all, become what we would call a moderate drinker, then that's something that you've made as a good judgment. But if you have something in your genetic makeup, then the likelihood is that you're going to continue drinking in spite of the negative consequences.
So, I mean, this whole series we're in called Crave, that would apply to any one of the craves we talked about, food, sex, today talking about alcohol. Why does a person, from your perspective, who has negative consequences with drinking or any of the others, continue to do it?
Your brain's actually changed. And your brain is set up in such a fashion or a condition that it craves the alcohol. And we refer to it as the point at which you tip over. And I can't tell you for any individual when that tip over point's going to come. I'm a very strong believer that many people are born alcoholic because they're 2 ounces, 3 ounces in the womb, and their mom has a beer every day. Whoops, that's a tremendous amount of alcohol. And if you have any element of precipitation in there, so many, many young people start their life that way.
Yeah. But as I look back on my past, it's like, okay, so I'm in college deciding to drink and realizing in myself this, what would you call it, this desire to not have 2 beers, to go to the third and the fourth. Every time I drank, it was never one. It was always like, let's go farther. But until I heard you talk about this, I never connected dots like predisposition. Mm-hmm. My past, thinking almost every single night of my life from 5, 6, 7, 8 years old to 17, 18 years old, always seeing mom and dad with a glass of vodka or gin every night. So, for someone like me, if I came into you and said, hey, Jack, do you think I should drink? What advice would you give a guy like me?
The advice that I would give you is to remember the Paisley song does a really good job of talking about the personality of alcohol. And the personality of alcohol is it's cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful, and it's infinitely patient. The fastest growing segment of people that fit the diagnosis of alcoholism today are people over the age of 55. and it's going up faster up in each age group beyond that. We have the two groups that we're most concerned about in terms of getting information out there, and that's the young, and the folks over 55. So I know you're not over 55, but I would think with your family tree, it just is something that I would say, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the amazing thing from in my story, and I'm guessing a lot of people this weekend, light bulbs are going on right now. You may have your schedule full of people coming in, but, you know, just connecting some of the dots, it's like, I never was told this, never thought, okay, so I had an alcoholic mom and dad that would, you know, I'm like, I'm not them. Even though it split up our home, I'm not them, I can handle it. And so I made a decision based on just wise counsel to not have alcohol in my home. It just is like, duh. Now, I know there's some people probably sitting out there going, well, I didn't have alcoholic parents, I can handle it. What do you say to them? Maybe they can. Is that what you say? Or?
Well, I'd say to them, take a look at your life. Yeah. Is the consumption of alcohol getting in your way? Is it interfering? If it's getting in your way, if it's interfering, if it's causing problems in your marriage, if it's causing problems at work, then I would ask you to do a simple little thing. Now remember, simple and easy aren't synonyms, okay? But I'm going to ask you to do a simple little thing. Don't drink for 30 days.
At all.
And as you make the decision to be free of alcohol for 30 days, take a look to see how you feel about that. Okay? And if at the end of that 30 days, talk to someone who has background or experience in the area, and you may come to the conclusion that, yeah, things are okay. Or you may come to the conclusion, I had a little bit more of an issue here than I thought that I did.
Now talk about the person that's affected by alcohol in their home or in a friendship or a relationship at work, that they're not the one drinking, but they're living close in a relationship or, you know, some kind of relationship with somebody that is. What do they do? How do they make a difference? How do they help this person see? Can they? Or they just throw up their hands like this and say, there's nothing I can do?
The biggest thing that that I really want people to take home is that term hostage. It sounds almost brutal, okay? But I want the people to take home the word hostage, and I want them to do an evaluation of themselves. Have they and the rest of the family become hostage to alcohol? And that's the first step. If you accept the fact that you truly are not in a relationship with this person, you're just simply hostage to their alcohol, that'll cause a mind change almost immediately. From there, then, there are a variety of different things. You know, our recovery groups here on Monday nights do a really good job of helping people whose lives have been made unmanageable because of somebody else's drinking. There's Al-Anon for people. Al-Anon's an amazing group that was actually started by the wife of the guy who created Alcoholics Anonymous because she wasn't real sure what to do once he got into recovery because she'd been codependent, co-alcoholic, whatever term you want to use, for so many years that she also had stopped growing and stopped maturing. So it's really important to spend time with people who've been down the road, you know, who've been there in front of you, and to get their wise counsel.
So that community aspect is huge. I mean, we've said it every week in this series, but hopefully people hear that, to go to a safe place where other people know the struggle and can share with you and go forward, hopefully, right?
Correct.
So many people that drink don't think they have a problem, so they're not willing to admit they have a problem. What do you do with a person like that, especially if that's somebody you're in a relationship with?
Well, let me just say one thing that, again, might be controversial, but I've been doing this for 30 years.
You're good at the controversial.
Yeah. I've never met an alcoholic who didn't know they were an alcoholic. Mm. It's just that they haven't been willing to face it yet. It's just that they haven't been willing to turn it over.
Okay? So you're saying deep in their soul, they know there's a problem here.
Yes. Good. Yeah. But the personality of the hostage taker is so strong that it blocks them from doing anything about it. My experience is the people who are the low bottoms, the folks that are not at the physiological dependency level yet, which is not necessarily a synonym there, so I want to be careful. Yes, there are low bottoms that need to be detoxed. But the low bottoms seem to be willing to accept a recommendation or a suggestion that they go to an AA meeting. And what a great place to start. If you think you're beginning to have issues and concerns with alcohol, AA it's everywhere. At three meetings a day at least, and places all over.
Yeah.
So if someone tells you they can't get to an AA meeting, whoops, sure they can.
Yeah,
they're everywhere. And what a wonderful place to start in terms of beginning to get an idea in terms of looking at life without alcohol. That's the part of it. The issue in terms of the family and the people who are concerned and affected, you asked me about the wife or the husband. You should hold that person accountable for their conduct. And if you are a wife or a husband and you are committed in the sickness and health, and yet this is a disease, then I think that a very important step is some form of an intervention, some form of bringing people together who can sit down with the individual and honestly say to that individual, this is the way your drinking is negatively affecting my life. This is the way your drinking is getting in the way of us being able to move forward as a family. And a variety of people can and should be involved. Most folks who talk about the recovery process will tell you that that hearing from their coworkers and their bosses was a much more powerful thing than hearing from members of their family.
Really?
There are people out there now through the different services that are mentioned in the materials we're giving out who have intervention specialists on staff who can teach you how to do a beginning stage intervention, who actually can come in and run an intervention in your home for you if it's something that you would prefer to have a professional do.
Yeah, because it sounds to the typical person pretty scary to think that I would confront my dad or my spouse without a little help. Like you said, there's some skilled professionals or people at least have done it. Have you seen those done? Some kind of intervention, like you said, it's better to have just more than just family members there. Do you see success?
If there's a plan.
Really?
There has to be a plan. If I say to you, I'm concerned about your use of alcohol, and I don't have a plan, I wasted your time and my time. I may even have raised the risk for you. So I have to be in a situation where, and that's where, talking to an intervention specialist, I have to be in a situation where someone who is a recovering person can say, and as soon as this is over, I want you to go to this AA meeting with me. Or the intervention specialist can say, and this is the treatment program we're recommending for you. We already have the airplane ticket. You're on your way to wherever, or I'll drive you there myself, or I want to take you to the emergency room to start the detoxing process, because there needs to be a plan right there so that the individual can see that it wasn't just smoke, because she's been told so often, stop drinking, stop drinking.
Yeah.
We want this to actually be an intervention.
Wow.
And the intervention needs to be honest, but you need to use common sense in the intervention. But you also have to have compassion, because I don't know anybody who wants to be an alcoholic. No 5-year-old or 15-year-old or 55-year-old said, "Oh, I think I'll wake up tomorrow and destroy my life." What a great idea!
Yeah.
No, so you have to. Sorry. I've seen this kill so many people. The compassion grows out of knowing that individual is lonely, they're isolated, and they really want help. And the compassion also operates along the line. There's good news. People by the tens of thousands gain control over this disease and go on to lead full, beautiful, balanced lives.
You know, I've known Jack Wilson for almost 8 years. In fact, my wife Chris and I were in a small group with Jack and Kathy here at Kensington. I've had dozens and dozens of conversations over a cup of coffee with Jack where he's trying to straighten me out and help me, with a little bit of success along the way. He's witty, he's funny, he's smart. We've talked about everything you can imagine, and yet I have never seen him broken, break down like he did there. When I watched the video last night for the first time, I was so shocked. I didn't know what was coming. And when he went there, it just was stunning for me. You know, he was being factual and informational and kind of talking like a clinical psychologist, and not a lot of affect was there. And then all of a sudden, didn't it feel that way out of nowhere? He just begins to weep. He didn't see it coming. In fact, when the cameras were shut off and he was asked, you know, what happened in that moment? He said, for some reason, in that moment, he saw the faces of all the men and the women and the children over the years that he's tried to help, that he's had the opportunity to come alongside and try to help, and all the pain and devastation, even death, that he's had to face. It just hit him like a wave, and he just felt that strong compassion. But, you know, he talked about 15%, right? You heard that number of people? But that's just a big number. It really does come down to everyone is a story. Everyone is a person. Everyone is a life that is of value to God. And it's devastating to watch someone self-destruct through anything, but in this case, through alcohol, to watch their lives, for a person just to throw their life away, not only their life, but to bring pain and devastation into the people that they love and that love them. And I bet you some of you have seen that happen. You've been maybe a victim of that. Maybe you're in it right now. I talked to someone after the first service down front here who is in it right now. Well, this week, knowing we were going to have this focus today, there were two women, two sisters at Kensington that asked if they could come in and talk to us and tell us their story. And so just to make this real as possible, I want to just tell you a little bit of what we learned. Two sisters, their name were Jean and Mary, and they got married, and their husbands became really good friends, and so they did a lot of stuff together. Well, what happened over time is the drinking, the little kind of fun social guys-will-be-guys drinking, began to get worse and worse and worse, and it was clear that there was a problem. And all efforts to talk sense into them as their lives began to unravel fell on deaf ears. And in 2005, Mike, who is married to Jean, died because of alcohol. And as you see the picture of him with his two twin daughters on the screen, you realize, you know, we think about alcoholics sometimes as the guy stumbling down the road and into the gutter. These two men, Oakland County, successful in their jobs, wonderful families, alcoholics. And now he's left his wife and his two daughters to live the rest of their lives without him. Jean wrote a letter to, she called it, this is a letter to alcoholism. I want to read what she wrote. You have destroyed my family. You have taken the man I married nearly 10 years ago and turned him into a complete stranger, a cruel, mean, heartless stranger. He could only focus on one thing, alcohol. He couldn't focus on his two beautiful daughters. You have stolen that from him. You have stolen their father from them. They have never known a healthy father. You came into our lives and took all of the normal, healthy bonds that exist in a family, and you drowned them. And for that, I feel complete hatred for you. Talking to alcohol. When Mike was dying in the hospital, he said to Jean that at least his brother-in-law, Eugene, would know now that he has to stop. Seeing what it did to him, Eugene at least will be saved or rescued. Well, 3 months ago, Eugene died, leaving not only Mary, but his two boys, as you can see their picture, fatherless. And Mary took up her pen and wrote these words in her journal, which she shared with us. Because of the bottle, my husband lost his career, his wife, his family, his home, his self-respect, his true friends, his purpose, his drive, his energy, his passion, his health, and finally, his very life. Because of the bottle, my sons are asleep in my room instead of their own beds because they need to feel safe and secure, close to the only parent they now have. Because of the bottle, boys are fatherless. Because of the bottle, they will never feel his arms wrapped around them again. Well, that's pretty horrible stuff, isn't it? And why share that with you? For this reason, I believe even here in church, there are people that are on that path. Some of you are on that path. And I bet when you were listening to Dr. Wilson talk, there was something uncomfortable happening. You were feeling some stirring. Maybe the defensiveness and the denial was there, but you felt some of that tugging in your heart, knowing that that's the path that you might be on. And our desire, our reason, the reason why we take on a topic like this is that we feel our responsibility, and what we want to do is to try to throw a rescue ring, throw a life ring to you, because there is hope. As Jack said at the end, the last thing he said, I don't know if you caught it, but he said there are tens of thousands of people who have found a way out of this. It doesn't have to end the way it ended for these two families. And so I want to do, just in the limited time that we have, I just want to share, actually there was three things I wanted to share, and Jack shared most of the first one, so I'm going to go over that real quick and jump into the next two. The first one is this. And it's true, no matter what our struggle is, it always has to start with an honest self-assessment. If we don't go there, we don't go anywhere. An honest self-assessment. And it might be for you, or it might be for someone in your life. That was the conversation I had down here after the first service. It was about somebody else. But that person was in denial. There needs to be an honest self-assessment of what's going on so that appropriate action can be taken. And so Jack talked about looking at your family tree. Let me tell you one other story real quickly. There's a woman that came to me a while ago, and she told me her story. I'll try to picture this. Her dad was an alcoholic, and when she was 6 or 7 years old, her dad would get his paycheck on Friday and go cash the check and go right to the bars, and you wouldn't usually come home until Saturday or Sunday. And by then, almost all the money was gone. And so all week long, they would go hungry. There wouldn't be any food in the house. And so when she was 6 or 7, her mom started on Friday evening when dad didn't get home to send him out in the neighborhoods walking to the different bars to try to find dad and beg him to come home. Now think about a 7-year-old going through that. And she, as she told me it, she said she was frightened, it was humiliating. She would go in the bars and there were things going on she didn't understand. Sometimes her dad would, when she found her dad, would put her up on the stool and offer her a beer, or he'd get mad at her and scream at her and chase her out. She never knew what she was going to experience, and this went on week after week, month after month. The woman who told me the story, and I didn't know it all the years growing up, was my mom. That was my grandpa. She had one sister. Her sister, about 10 years ago, in a drunken stupor, fell down the steps in her house, hit her head on the concrete basement floor, and died. So look at your family tree. Here's my family tree. Alcoholic grandfather, an aunt, my mom's sister who was an alcoholic. The interesting thing for my grandfather, by the way, is I didn't know all this years growing up because my grandfather was awesome. He took me fishing, spent time with me, love to tell me stories from the Bible because he found rescue in his 50s or 60s. And so all the years growing up, all I knew was this great-grandfather. It was only after he died that my mom told me the story of who he had been. It was a great story of redemption and how he met Jesus. Because he was actually the stereotype of that man in Detroit, stumbling into the gutter, passed out, going to rescue missions and shelters. But he had this amazing encounter with Jesus that totally changed his life. So there is hope. So, honest assessment, where are you at? Now, the other two things I want to share with you, I realize, just looking at the size of this crowd, that some of you maybe have already kind of switched me off because maybe you don't really have any alcohol problem in your immediate family and you personally, and so you're not sure the relevance of this message for you. So here's what I'm going to ask you to do. There's probably a few people here like that. I'm going to ask you, when I say alcohol for the next 12 minutes now, that you put in the blank whatever your struggle is. It might be one of the other weeks. You know, we talked about how the need for approval last week. We talked about sex 2 weeks ago. We talked about body image and food and that whole thing. So, or maybe it's something else altogether. Whatever that struggle is that you wish you could be freed from, insert that, because the last two things I want to share fit no matter what the issue is. But you're going to zero in specifically on alcohol. Here's the second thing. I want you to do a little mind experiment here. Use your imagination. If God exists, and I believe he does, but there might be some here who are searching and trying to figure that out. But if God exists and he created you, then he knows everything about you. Would you agree? If he's a creator, there's no secrets with God. Now, do you have any secrets from other people? I do. Things that, you know, you're working on, but you're not, you know, you wouldn't want to share. God sees everything. So take whatever that issue is, alcohol in this case, and I want you to imagine for a moment that God is with you now one-on-one and he's looking at you. And your eyes meet. Use your imagination. Try to picture that. What do you see in God's face? How is he looking at you? What does he convey? How does he feel about you with this problem that you have? I have to tell you, this is the most important thing when it comes to understanding what a life of faith in Jesus is about. If you have any other picture in your mind as you did that experiment, then a God, actually, when I watched that interview, the first thing I felt when I watched Jack break down like that and cry is that's exactly how God feels. That's exactly how Jesus feels about the struggles that we're having. It's not anger. It's not frustration. It's not impatience. It's compassion. It's love. Because he knows that it can be different. He knows it can be better. He knows that he can help. He knows it doesn't have to go that way. But I bet you many of you, if you did it and you pictured in your mind, it was a different kind of picture. It was for me most of the years of my life, if I'm honest with you. No matter what people taught or said or what I read in the Bible, I still had this idea that God really did want me to get things together so then we could be in relationship, so then he could love me. Because everything else in life is about performance. You have to perform to be approved. We tend to judge people and dismiss people if they don't perform up to our expectations. And so we think God's the same way, and there's plenty of preachers and messages we've heard that have kind of conveyed that idea. And so what happens is we get stuck in our stuff because we don't understand that God is the most powerful ally to help us out of our stuff. In fact, Jesus got a reputation when he was here on earth. And it was a good or bad reputation depending on who you are. One of the criticisms was he hung out with the wrong people. And here's how Jesus said it. He said, "You're criticizing me. You're saying that the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say, here's a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax gatherers and sinners." Is it possible that when God came into the world, that's what the story of Christmas is about, God becoming a person in the incarnation. Is it possible that this God, when he walked the earth and bumped into people who were broken and messed up, that he actually liked being with them? And here's the amazing thing. Think about this. And they liked being with him. You know, a lot of people in where I live and stuff know I'm a pastor. And I've always felt like one of the real tests of whether I get this right is, do people enjoy my company? Especially people who are the most messed up. Do they like being with me? Because if they don't, then I don't get it. Because they loved being with Jesus. And Jesus loved being with them. And he got criticized for it. You're hanging out. You're a friend of sinners. They meant it as a criticism. I think Jesus took that as the highest compliment because that's why he came. He came for people who were broken. And so take your issue. If it's drinking right now and you're not sure what you're going to do out of this message, if you're going to go and try to get help or whatever you're going to do, but if you're thinking, now what does God feel about this? Because we're in church, so we're talking about God, right? What does God feel about you? He's your friend. He's your ally. In fact, one of the verses I've come to love over the years, in the interest of time, I'm just going to reference it. It's Matthew 11. And we talk about this quite often at Kensington because it's a picture of who Jesus really is. Matthew, quoting Jesus, says this. Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened down, and I will give you rest. Come to me, alcoholic. Come to me, drug addict. Come to me, sex addict. Come to me, person who needs anger management help. Come to me, greedy person. Come to me, whatever. This is the position. If you imagine Jesus standing before you, if you imagine God, you're in the presence of God with your problems, with your struggles. He knows everything about you. I don't know much about most of you. But he knows everything. And we're used to thinking if someone knew the real me, they wouldn't love me, they would reject me. Jesus made abundantly clear how God feels about you. I see everything. Here's my stance towards you. Arms wide open. Come. Come to me. You're weary. You're burdened down with sin. Jesus even said that sin, if you're caught in sin, habitual sin, he said, you're like a slave and it's your master. And how does a slave get freed? Someone's got to emancipate him. Jesus said, that's why I came. I came knowing you're all messed up so I could help you. So the worst thing we could do is ever convey a message that whatever your problem is, you got to kind of work on it before you can even think about God. It's totally the opposite. Think God first. Turn to him. Invite him to be a part of getting out of whatever you're in. And there is hope. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, Jack referenced it, has been just an amazing group, organization that's been around for many years that have helped so many people. Every time this topic comes up, I meet people at Kensington who, like after the last service, 23 years, the man said, "I've been sober. AA is how I got out." This is kind of an interesting sidelight. I don't know if you've heard this yet, but our church that we're starting in New York City, in Manhattan, we finally have an office. The address is even on my business card now. And the address is 61 Gramercy Park North. Now, why is that significant? Well, it's not really, except this. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded by a man by the name of Bill W. If you're an AA, you know that name. Bill W. founded AA in New York City in Manhattan, and his office was 61 Gramercy Park North. And I was sitting there last Wednesday in the office at a meeting, looking at the walls, thinking about what God did there to bring hope to people, to bring freedom to people who are trapped in alcohol. And I don't know if you know the 12 steps. I'm not going to obviously go through all of them. I just want to tell you the first few, because it's exactly what Jesus is about, what God's about with you and your struggle. The first one is that we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. That's the honest assessment that Jack was talking about. The second one is that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us. You know, I'd actually like to, maybe when I get in my office, I'll rewrite that second one. I don't know if AA will let me do it. Because I would like to make that could word stronger, that there's a power greater than ourselves that longs to restore us, that whose greatest desire is to restore us, who breaks down like Jack did when he sees our anguish and our pain and what it's causing. He says, I can do something about that. I can set you free from that. That he longs to restore us and to give us new life and to give us hope and to give us a new future and to set us free from that slavery to sin that we have. So I asked you a moment ago, when God looks at your problem in you, what do you see? I hope you are beginning to see, if you haven't already, a God who says, I'm here for you. My arms are open wide. Come, let me help you. Don't try to figure it out on your own. You can't. You're powerless. You can't do it. In fact, the third step of AA is that you have to come to the point, they said, where you surrender your will and your life to God. It's in that surrender that we find help. Honest assessment, turn to Jesus. Here's the last thing I want to share with you. To get help with anything, and it's especially true with addictions like alcohol, is you have to get into community. You have to be in community. What kind of community? That's an overused word. What kind of community? You know, I went to the hospital last week to Beaumont to visit somebody in our church who was sick. I don't know if you know this, but there's a lot of sick people in hospitals. I went floor after floor, room after room. They're all sick. It's like, I thought hospitals were about health, right? Aren't they about health? Why would you ever go to hospital if you're sick? Because all they have there are sick people. That's crazy. Now you're thinking, I'm crazy right now. Hospitals exist for sick people, right? What do churches exist for? What was God's vision when he started the church? What was Jesus' vision for what he called his bride? What kind of community is that supposed to be? Can you imagine this? Can you imagine if, let's say I hurt my leg. Okay, so I hurt it and I need to get x-ray. I'm limping and I pull up. Someone drops me off at the door of Beaumont Hospital. And as soon as I get to the door, I go, I'm okay. I don't need any help. I'm healthy. See, I'm in a hospital. No, you go in, you go, oh, it hurts, and here's what's wrong, and I got to show you. I got to, you know, pull up my pants and show you the cut or the sprain or whatever it's there and x-ray it and help, you know, give me some help, heal me. That's what a church is supposed to be. You know, people say that a church, I'm not going to go to church because they're full of hypocrites. You know why that there's truth to that? Because we haven't taught very well that when you come in that back door, this is the one place you can be who you are. We're no different than anybody else in the world. We're broken people. We have our struggles and our sin. But somehow we got the idea that when you come to church, you got to dress it up and you got to hide it and you got to make it look good, right? No, that's not what Jesus had in mind at all. The church is more like a hospital than any other thing I can think of. And Jesus said it himself. Because when he got criticized again another time for hanging out with sinners, here's what he said. He said, it is not the healthy that need a doctor, it's the sick. Now, he wasn't calling them healthy. He said, you think you're healthy? Then there's no place for you here in my community. Because you're not going to want what we have to offer. But when you come to me, Jesus said, when you come become a part of this community, then what you're saying is, I am a broken person who needs help. And so this should be the one place, whether it's in this large gathering that's hard to do here in a large group or it's in your smaller groups, that's why we push small groups all the time, is you have to find a place in this community where you can say, with you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know how their meetings start? Someone gets up front and says, my name's Craig and I'm an alcoholic. All right, so guess what? No pretending here. The whole reason why I'm in this room is because I need help. And the reason why I've been involved in church all my life is because I need help. And I know that God can help me in ways that I cannot help myself. And I know that when I'm with a community of people where we can be honest with each other and open with our struggles and who we are, that it's in that place that the power of God is unleashed. His power and the power of a community together. This is a hospital, Kensington Community Hospital. Can we change the name? Can we do that? Do we on the stationery? Is that possible? But you understand what I'm saying? This is his vision for us. This is his vision for a community, that we would be people that are able to come together and be who we are, because it's in that brokenness and honesty and repentance and confession and a cry for help that we do together that the power of God is unleashed. AA, since 1934 or 5, whenever it was founded, has proven that. You know, in New York City, every day in New York City, I found this out, there's 5,000 AA groups that meet every single day in New York City. And what those groups represent, I know they're not all Christian, they're not all lifting up Jesus, some are and some aren't, but what they're saying is we understand that the only way to health begins with honesty and brokenness and surrender. And that's what Jesus came to declare. Jesus is not saying to any one of us here this morning, not until you get it together, it's no, come, let me help you. You can't do it on your own. This is a place for broken people to learn together how to be healthy as we learn how to follow Jesus. That's the vision. And this whole Crave series now, as we kind of wrap this up, wherever you self-identified your struggle, Jesus longs to step into that, and we long as a community to step in that together, that we would find healing and we would find health here. Well, we want to finish up with an opportunity to sit in this for a little bit and try to listen to God. Because, you know, it doesn't matter what my opinion is. If to the extent that I'm communicating what is true and how Jesus feels, then my prayer is that in these closing moments, you will sense that, not from my voice, but from God, that God would speak to each of us where we sit to begin a journey out of this. There are a lot of resources, in fact, in your program, I encourage you to look later, of things that we have a recovery group that meets on Monday nights at our Troy campus called Celebrate Recovery. It's for all kinds of addictions, including alcohol. You know, if you need this, jump in. Be a part of this. But know that God longs to meet you. And to begin the process, that's my prayer, even today, to begin the process, the journey to health that is possible. Because Jesus said, when the Son of Man sets you free, you are free indeed. He can set us free from that. I'm going to invite the ushers to come as we're getting ready for the song and as the band comes out. And if you're a guest today, if you're a visitor, we are so glad you're here. This financial moment is not for you. Feel free just to let the basket go by. We're so glad that you decided to spend an hour with us. But as you listen to the words of this song, God gave this song, I think, as a gift to our church. Danny Cox, our music director, wrote the song, felt like God inspired him, gave him the words, gave him the music for this song. And the song, as you hear the words that Amanda's going to sing, are really about a conversation with God. Even some uncertainty still. Like, God, is this really true? Could you really heal me? Could you really put the pieces of my life back together? Because my life is anything but perfect. God, could you? Is this really true? So my prayer is as you hear the words of this song, let the love of God wash over you. Let him know that as he sees you as you are, that he loves you as you are, but he desires to make you different. And he alone has the ability to do that.